Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
So this is the 14th annual Lenore Lectureship. This lecture was established by Dr. Robert Hamburger, who's here in the audience. This lectureship coincides with Martin Luther King Day. For those of you who don't know Dr. Hamburger, he is UCSD Emeritus Professor in Pediatrics, and he's on staff here at Rady Children's. He came to UCSD from Yale in 1960 to join the newly created Department of Biology. He was one of the founding fathers of the medical school at UCSD in 1965, and he served as the assistant dean for the first 8 years. He also served as the chief of division of pediatric immunology and allergy for more than 20 years and trained tons of pediatric allergists over the years, many who are still here in San Diego and have spread all over the world. He is well known for his work on mechanisms of IgE-mediated diseases. Now, the lectureship was formed in memory of the wife of one of UCSD's first allergy immunology fellows, Dr. Michael Lenore. Dr. Lenore's wife, Andrea, died during a severe asthma attack at a really young age. And after completing fellowship here at UCSD, Dr. Lenore just dedicated his life to helping patients with asthma, particularly asthmatics in the inner city. He actually was the first speaker, as you can see, of this lectureship, and he spoke on inner-city asthma. Since that time, the lectureship has had two major themes. It's either the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of allergy, immunologic, or asthma, and the other theme is health disparities, which we'll hear about a little bit more today. As you can see, the speakers, we've had a really amazing group of speakers over the last 12 to 13 years, except maybe for last year, but 12 out of 13 is not bad. I had to fill in last year. This year, we're making up for last year. We've got Lyndia, who you all know, Lyndia Willis-Jacoba. She is a clinical professor of pediatrics and the assistant dean for diversity and community partnerships. She's been in San Diego an incredibly long time. She did her undergraduate degree here. She did her medical school degree here. She did her residency and chief residency. And then she joined the faculty in 1996. She has several publications. She served on numerous committees. But one of probably her real standout accomplishments is her teaching. She's actually been recognized for her teaching at every stage of her career here in San Diego. And actually, she has more teaching awards than she's been here years in San Diego. So anyway, I'd like to welcome Lyndia.
Good morning. It is truly an honor and a privilege to be here for such an important lectureship. I see many of my mentors, many of my friends and colleagues in the audience. And as Hal mentioned, I've been here in San Diego at UC San Diego since 1983. So if you do the math, it's been many years. So what I'm going to do today is talk with you about health disparities. And I'm really going to focus on disparities in children. And when I finished my residency in 1996, I developed a scholarly interest in the area of cultural competency in the practice of medicine, and I was specifically interested in how culture impacts one's day-to-day clinical encounter. And over the years, though, it's become very clear to me that though cultural competency continues to be extraordinarily important in one's day-to-day practice, that it really represents only a very small piece of a much larger and a much more complicated story. And so I've been very fortunate in the last 2.5 years to oversee our program in medical education health equity. And for those of you who are not familiar with that program, it's a 5-year dual degree program for medical students who are interested in serving in caring for underserved populations. And so it really has been in this time that my sort of vision and scope and understanding of disparities has really broadened. So in the next 45 to 50 minutes, what I hope that I'll be able to provide you with are skills to learn some of the causes of health disparities in children in our country. And we'll talk some about the role that the social determinants play in health. I hope that by the end of the 50 minutes, you'll know the leading health disparities in children, that you'll become familiar with some of the strategies that have been designed to eliminate health disparities. And lastly, I hope that you'll understand, as pediatricians, our role in eliminating health disparities. And I'll go about that first by providing you with a few key definitions. We'll then talk a little bit about how we got here to talking about health disparities. I'll go through the social determinants of health because, as I'll walk you through this, that really plays a significant role in disparities, not only in adults, but in children as well. We'll go through some of the leading disparities in children and then talk a little bit about how we, what things we should be doing from here moving forward. So a few key definitions so that we're all on the same page throughout the talk. When we talk about a health disparity, we're really looking at differences in populations in various measures of health that occur by gender. They occur by race or ethnicity, education or income, one's level of ability or disability, and the locale in which one lives. So whether you live in an urban or a rural location. And this is taken directly from the Department of Health and Human Services. And depending on what you read, you may see different definitions. And it's really important to recognize that while the definitions are going to be quite varied, that it's ultimately, it should be specific enough in order to guide measurement as well as accountability. I think Margaret Whitehead, who is a public health researcher in the United Kingdom, has to date provided us with the very best definition of health equity. And she essentially defines health equity as equal access to available care for equal need, equal utilization for equal need, and equal quality of care for all. And that definition was essentially put forth to us in 1992, and I think certainly in 2012 remains quite relevant. So in that definition, there is an ethical value that's firmly grounded in the principle of distributive justice. So as we go through the talk, I would like for you to keep this particular definition in mind. Health inequities, then, are differences in health which are unnecessary, and they're avoidable. But they're also unfair and they're unjust. Again, a definition given to us by Margaret Whitehead. And implicit in this definition, then, is a moral and ethical judgment regarding the nature of these differences. So this is more than simply, you know, there are differences that we see. But it's important to remember that these are unfair and unjust differences. When we talk about underrepresented minority groups, I'll show quite a bit of data on that. We're really looking at on populations who come from backgrounds that are from Latino backgrounds, from African-American backgrounds, and I will be using the term African-American and Black interchangeably. Those who are from Asian and Pacific Islander backgrounds, and Native American and Alaska Native backgrounds. And this definition comes directly from the Institute of Medicine, but it also, if you look at the definition given to us by the Office of Minority Health, it also gives the very same definition. Quality of care, this is a pretty important one to keep in mind, and it typically is measured based on six dimensions. So care that's of high quality should be care that's equitable, it's care that's efficient, it's care that's effective, it's care that's accessible, and it's care that's acceptable, meaning that it's really patient-centered. So the patient needs to buy into what you're doing as well in order for this to meet the criteria of quality of care, and it must be safe. So how did this story of health disparities begin? Well, I think as we often see in the practice of pediatrics, much of these stories begin in the adult literature and in the very early 1990s. So I think I was an intern or a second year resident, actually an intern at the time. There were numerous articles being published throughout the adult literature, and most of these articles were looking at chronic diseases, things like cardiovascular disease, renal disease, and what they essentially were showing is that there were significant differences in the quality of care when one looked at minority patients compared to white patients. And it was rather striking. And because of its striking nature, Congress essentially tasked the Institute of Medicine with looking into these differences a bit more critically. And the request from Congress was very specific. So they were essentially asked to assess the extent of racial and ethnic differences in the quality of health care received by patients. And The important aspect of this is that factors such as access to care, ability to pay, insurance, etc., were to be excluded from those analyses. The second specific request was that they were asked to evaluate potential sources of disparities, namely bias, discrimination, stereotyping. And then the third request was that they provide recommendations regarding interventions to eliminate healthcare differences. And this was quite a huge task. There was a 15-member committee put together. They essentially were comprised of people with different levels of expertise. So there were healthcare economists, there were healthcare service researchers, anthropologists, etc. And they met roughly five times. There were numerous panel discussions, workshops were held, the communities were engaged, and they also did something interesting. They had focus group discussions, and they essentially got minority patients and minority providers, so physicians and nurses also participated in this. So this was roughly a 9 to 12 month endeavor, so it was quite an extensive thing. And the important aspect of this report is that it really represented the very first comprehensive evidence-based document, which essentially showed us that there were significant disparities in healthcare quality. So this was an over 700-plus pages, this report. It really is a book. But to summarize some of the findings, they essentially found that if you were a minority patient, when compared to whites, you were less likely to be given appropriate cardiac medicines or undergo coronary bypass surgery. Okay, they further showed that you were also less likely to receive kidney dialysis or transplants. And remember, there were certain factors that were held constant. So you were less likely to receive the best diagnostic tests or treatments for stroke or cancer. And when it came to HIV/AIDS, you were essentially much less likely to get state-of-the-art treatments that would really forestall the onset of the disease. You were more likely, though, more likely to get less desirable treatments. So what are those? Well, essentially, you were more likely to get a hysterectomy if you were a minority woman, and you were also much more likely to get an amputation if you were a minority patient. So what were some of the reasons when the committee really looked at well over 100 articles and spoke to people that could account for some of these disparities? Well, there were issues of cultural and language barriers, and I think that's fairly clear because if you cannot communicate with your patient, then chances are the outcomes are not going to be good. We know that there's data, there's literature showing that. Time limitations on us as clinicians and pressures of clinical practice were thought to be one potential reason, though, you know, you can take that for what it's worth. The third bullet is really interesting. There was significant distrust for the healthcare establishment by many minority patients. And by way of oral history, there continues to be stories being told of the Tuskegee syphilis study, which continued on from 1932 to 1972. So that was essentially a 40-year study. And more recently, with the publication of the book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, there continues to be and even a more recent conversation about the Henrietta Lacks story. And it's really interesting because I think that in day-to-day practice, these are not necessarily things we think about. I certainly don't necessarily think about those on a day-to-day basis, but we have to keep in mind that our patients do. We all know that our healthcare workforce is by no means as diverse as our country is becoming. We know that by 2050, we will no longer have the majority population as we know today. And our healthcare workforce has not yet begun to catch up to that. So not in the U.S. and certainly not in California. So the lack of minority physicians, it becomes an issue as well when we have conversations about racial and ethnic disparities in healthcare. And then the fifth point is one that I think only recently has really begun to emerge in the literature, and that is conscious or subconscious biases, prejudices, and negative stereotypes or perceptions that affect the way providers deliver care. And the stereotype literature is very, very interesting because we would like to think that we're very objective people, and that anybody who comes into our clinic settings, our hospital settings, that we really treat them in exactly the same way. But in fact, what the literature tells us is that because we have very deeply rooted stereotypes, that we don't do that. And I think that for physicians especially has been extraordinarily difficult to grapple with. One of the papers reviewed during the Institute of Medicine's report was by Gomez and McGuire, and I think they put together a pretty nice model for looking at disparities, differences, and discrimination. And so if you look again, this is summing up what I've already said, at quality of care for minority versus non-minority patients, much of the difference that we see essentially covers three dimensions, certainly patient behaviors, but also the operation of the healthcare system and provider behavior. When you look at disparities, though, what we know is that it's primarily our behavior as providers, as well as how we operate as a healthcare system, that really creates more of the problems than patient behavior. So I would like to now provide you with the focus group highlights. And when patients and providers were essentially interviewed, when they held focus groups, there were themes that were essentially put together. And so things like discrimination, so people were asked about that, language issues, etc. So what I'm going to now do is share with you from the doctor's and the patient's perspective some of how they view disparities. So a Latino patient said, "My name is Gonzalez," and basically the way it played out is it could have been any other Latino surname. And from this patient's perspective, this is from the patient's voice, when they see that name, I think there is some kind of prejudice of the name. We're talking about on the phone. There's a lack of respect. So that was the theme. There's a lack of acknowledging the person and making one feel welcome. All of the courtesies that go with the profession that are that they're paid to do are kind of put aside. They think that they can get away with a lot because here's another dumb Mexican. So that's from a Mexican-American person's perspective. A Chinese patient said, "I have a desire to improve my English so that I can go to an American doctor and get better treatment." I found this particular quote intriguing because here it is. There's a patient who is equating, in their own mind, speaking better English with the quality of care that they receive. And again, we would like to think that those should really be not certainly related. An African-American patient said that oftentimes the system gets the concept of black people off the 6 o'clock news, and they treat us all the same way. Here's a guy coming in here with no insurance. He's low breed. And I'll finish up with two comments, one from a nurse, one from a physician. A Latina nurse essentially said that it's very difficult to recruit Latinos for clinical trials who cannot understand the consent form. I felt there was some resistance to spending extra time counseling Spanish speakers. I was told that it was just not really necessary, that I can just give them a synopsis of what is in the consent form. And I said, "Wait a minute, this is a very important piece of paper. Why should it be different? You don't give a synopsis to English speakers." So you can see sometimes the double standard there. And lastly, an African-American physician says, "Of course, in psychiatry, we see this discrimination. One area we see this is in terms of diagnosis. Patients are inappropriately diagnosed and medications prescribed for the patients. We see errors in that. Minority patients will often be diagnosed inappropriately as being schizophrenic." And one of our colleagues in the Department of Psychiatry, Andres Sciola, actually, this is a scholarly interest of his, and he recently gave a presentation where he very thoroughly reviewed the psychiatry literature as it pertained to disparities in this area, and it was pretty shocking. It's rather interesting, and I hope that we all get an opportunity to hear him present that at some point. Maybe we can invite him. So, what about pediatrics? How are we doing? Well, the American Academy of Pediatrics, which is essentially the major professional association for pediatricians in our country, essentially we have a motto. We say that we are committed to the attainment of optimal physical, mental, and social health and well-being for all infants, children, and adolescents and young adults. So how do we think that we're doing just in general in terms of caring for our children? Well, I think for some kids we're doing okay, unfortunately, we're not doing great for most kids, but for many, we're simply not doing very good. And so this is a report put out by the Children's Defense Fund, which is a nonprofit organization entitled The State of America's Children. And this is an annual report that this group puts out. And this is looking at our country internationally on a few child health indicators. And this is comparing us to 32 countries. And so there are a couple areas that we are ranking very well in. We are first in gross domestic product at around $15.1 trillion, I think was the last figure that I saw from last year. We're also first in the number of billionaires that we have. We have roughly 403 of those. We are first in number of persons incarcerated in our country. We're also first in healthcare expenditure. So we spend of those $15.1 trillion about 17% of that. Okay, so do the math and you can see what that number turns out to be. We're, though, in spite of that, 22nd for low birth weight infants, and we're 30th for infant mortality rates. We're also last in the gap between rich and poor, and that's a very interesting and important measure because if you look at countries whereby their citizens, the members of those countries, are the healthiest, it's not necessarily those countries that spend the most in healthcare. It's really countries in which the gap between rich and poor is a little bit narrower than it is for us, okay? We're also last in our ability to protect our children from gun violence, and we're last in relative child poverty. And poverty is an incredibly important and very key social determinant of health. So we showed you a little bit of adult data looking at how race and ethnicity plays a role in this, and I'll continue to show you that for children as well because it's pretty much paralleled and it mirrors that for our kids. But poverty is extraordinarily important too, and like I said, it's a key determinant. So what are the social determinants of health? Well, it's essentially defined as those conditions in which people are born, they grow, live, work, and age. And that includes us. We're part of that, the healthcare system. And what we now know is that the social determinants of health are mostly responsible for many of the health inequities that we see. So I would argue that until we really fix some of our social and economic inequities, it's going to be extraordinarily difficult to battle such a big piece of the disparities picture, and that being health disparities. So the World Health Organization, I think, pose a very challenging question to all of us who care for patients, and they essentially say, why treat people without changing what makes them sick? I think that's an extraordinarily different way of looking at wellness and of how we care for our patients. So let's switch gears a bit and talk about the face of poverty. So what does poverty look like in our picture? And I would agree with all of you that this is a pretty dismal looking photo, and it's intentionally dismal looking because when you're impoverished, that's how dismal it is. And this is actually a picture of a neighborhood. You cannot see it all that well, unfortunately. I apologize for that. Of a neighborhood in Baltimore, Maryland. And Baltimore, for those who don't know, is one of the most blighted communities in the country. So this is taken from the New York Times in 2010, and this was an article that they had published looking at the increase in poverty rate in 2009, and we were at the time at 14.3% as a country in terms of our poverty rates. I think we're currently at 15.1%. And to remind you, and I didn't change the poverty line here because when I relooked at it, it hasn't really changed a whole lot. So our federal poverty line was set at $10,830 in pre-tax cash income. And for a family of four, it's $22,050. Okay, and that is irrespective of what part of the country you reside in. Okay, so that's how much you would have if you're right at the poverty line. Looking at poverty rates over the decades, what we notice is that it's much higher, clearly, in kids. So people under the age of 18 are at higher risk, and that high risk began somewhere in the mid-1970s. When we look at the percentage of kids living in poverty, our current, I mentioned our poverty rate is right at around 15%. But what we know about kids is that about half of those kids who live in poverty live in extreme poverty. And what that means is that they're having difficulty meeting very basic needs. Okay, so things that we consider very basic, about half of kids who live in poverty, families struggle with that. And this is taken from the National Center for Children in Poverty. Race and ethnicity and looking at poverty tends to be very interesting because we see that poverty rates really run very directly along racial lines in our country. And sometimes the studies then are a little bit difficult to interpret because one wonders, well, is this really race that's playing a role or is it socioeconomics? And I would argue then that it's both. But we see that if you're Black, American Indian, or Latino in the U.S., you are at about your poverty rates run from 31 to 35% compared to other groups. This is another way of looking at poverty as it pertains to race in our country, because children living with a single parent, that's a proxy for poverty. So this is just showing exactly what I've said in a slightly different way. So we know that being poor carries a significant health burden for everyone, regardless of what country one lives in. And certainly in our country, that is no different. And so compared to higher income kids, when we look at kids from lower incomes, we see that they're almost five times as likely to be in only fair or poor health. They are three times as likely to have an unmet medical need. They are almost three times as likely to be uninsured and have no regular place for health care. They're more than twice as likely to not have seen a doctor for 2 years or delayed medical care due to cost. And lastly, they're 1.5 times as likely to miss 10 days or more of school due to illness or injury. So school absenteeism is also a problem in these kids. So how are we doing in California? I mentioned poverty rates, but we should look at ourselves. And in California, we are somewhere in the middle. So our rates are at around 16.1%. So if you look at the rest of the country, we're not in the 20% or more states, but we're still pretty high up at the end of that particular spectrum, with a lot of poverty concentrated down in the more southern states, as one would expect. So since that Institute of Medicine report came out, there have been numerous organizations who have been very, very motivated and very interested in this whole topic of health disparities. And so the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality began issuing an annual report beginning in 2003. And the primary goal of this report was really to track disparities in both quality and access to healthcare as it pertained to the groups that I mentioned earlier. And I'll just share a little bit of demographic information for you from that. And, you know, a quarter of people living in our country are children. I think the most striking demographic for us in the room is that almost 70% of kids in California happen to be from an ethnic minority group. So I think that is an important factor for us to keep in mind as we care for patients. And this just essentially gives you a bit of demographic information about uninsured kids in our country and sort of the kinds of households they're from, age groups. But the more striking things, again, a little bit of what I've already talked about, is if you look at the first arrow, it really looks at socioeconomic status, and certainly as that increases, your likelihood of having insurance goes up. And likewise, if you look at the breakdown of Latinos and African Americans, again, they tend to be the ones with higher uninsured rates. So let's talk about some of the leading health disparities in children. And we know, based on information not only from that report that I showed earlier, but from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, these are essentially the six top areas in which we see significant disparities along socioeconomic status, but also along racial categories. And I'll, in the interest of time, I'm only going to go through three of these. And the first one is infant mortality rates, which I think is very important to us. And it's defined as the number of deaths per 1,000 live births. So that's the definition of infant mortality rate. And there is some good news and bad news. So the good news is that if you look across several decades, infant mortality rate for most racial and ethnic groups has declined significantly. The bad news, though, is that when you piece out the infant mortality rates for various ethnic groups, there has been very little improvement noted in relative differences of infant mortality rates when one looks at primarily blacks and Native Americans. And it's most significant for black women, and I will show you some of that data. But before I do that, we can sort of compare how we do alongside six other industrialized countries. We're consistently higher. I think our newest infant mortality rate is at around 6.5 deaths per 1,000 live births. That was, I think, 2010 data. And Japan and Sweden have consistently done better with infant mortality rates. And there's a wonderful book. I'm only in the middle of the book, but it's called The Healing of America. And it's written by a Washington Post reporter, T.R. Reid. And it's a wonderful book because it really looks at these various healthcare systems. And it was striking reading the chapter on Japan, because after reading that, it became clearer to me how they've managed to keep their infant mortality rates as low as they have. Very, very interesting. And the interesting side note to that is they happen to have 3,500 different healthcare plans. So it's not an insurance issue. 3,500. Can you believe that? I'm showing this because the most significant disparities that we see happens between blacks and whites. Okay, I think sometimes when we have these conversations, I've been criticized by others saying, well, why do you always talk about black and white? And I guess I talk a little bit about it because that's what the data says. And so if the infant mortality rate story is a pretty interesting and striking one. And if you look at what has happened to the mortality rates for whites, it's gone down. And I think it's right at about that number, though it may be a little bit higher now, actually. If you look, though, at the infant mortality rate for blacks, it's pretty high still, right? So if you compare that rate, we are currently, for black women, where we were for others many decades back. So we've not made a lot of progress, I guess is what I'm saying. What's even more striking is if you look at infant mortality rates for mothers age 20 by race and ethnicity and level of education, with level of education, again, being a direct proxy for socioeconomic status. The more education you have, the more earning potential you have. If you are an uneducated black woman compared to one who's college plus educated, it's still pretty high, and you can compare that to other groups of people. And I think one would wonder if I'm making an argument for socioeconomics playing a significant role, for minority status playing an important role, why is it that for Latinos it's actually at about the rate of white moms, and sometimes even a bit lower? And that's called the Latino paradox. No one understands it. But what people believe, what the literature says, is that the thought is we still have a significantly high immigrant Latino population in our country, and that's believed to be protective. Because when you look at infant mortality rates for recently immigrated black women from other parts of the world, it's a lot lower than African American women. So it's incredibly interesting stuff, and it really makes one wonder, what exactly is going on? Is it truly just genetics? Well, I just told you that if you're an immigrant black woman, it looks a little bit different, so it may not be quite as genetically related as we thought. So Pradeep Mahuri in 2004 did a pretty large study looking at racial differences in the leading causes of death in our country. And he did it by linking birth and infant death records of over 23 million singletons belonging to six birth cohorts. So this was an enormous study, very large study. And what he found initially wasn't all that interesting. It basically told us that infant deaths were predominantly due to congenital anomalies, which we would expect, short gestation, low birth weight, sudden infant death syndrome, respiratory distress syndrome, and maternal complications. So that finding isn't all that striking. But what was quite striking is the fact that if you looked at the short gestation, low birth weight groups, it correlated very, very strongly with infant mortality, especially for black infants. And that was, by the way, even after adjusting for factors that we know affect infant mortality rates. So things like socioeconomic status, early maternal age, lack of prenatal care, and perinatal infections. And this is where the story gets sort of interesting. And I will warn you, it's rather preliminary data, but I will, information I should say, but I will share some of it with you because I find it rather interesting. So what might that mean? So this is sort of getting us closer to that original question of why is it that African-American women born in the U.S. seem to have consistently higher infant mortality rates? Well, Kramer and Hogue, in a very extensive review of this area, essentially looked at this topic and proposed the stress hypothesis. And we know that I talked earlier about the potential for genetic factors, but it doesn't quite fully add up in terms of accounting for the rather large differences in infant mortality rate disparities. So what they propose is that there are two types and time periods of psychosocial stress. So there's the acute stress we experience during pregnancy. So for anybody in the room who's been pregnant, that could mean getting up in the morning and having your spouse say, "How are you?" That's a stressor sometimes because most of the times you're not feeling great, right, when you're pregnant, right? And or it could be sort of the day-to-day stress that we all experience. But what they propose is that this is really about a life course exposure to stressors. So this is chronic. This is from the day that you're born, you're bombarded with these life course stressors. So what are these? Well, in 2007, there was a poll done by the Pew Research Center, and what they found was interesting, that 81% of blacks in our country report frequent experiences of discrimination in at least one of the following categories. So who would think applying for a job, eating in a restaurant, renting or buying a house, or applying to a university or college? And what we think is happening is that these there's a buildup of what we call microaggressions that occur with many of these people, such that it becomes a chore just existing. So this is, again, what the literature says. So how does that, though? What does that do to us physiologically? Well, there are three theories. The first theory is an endocrinologic theory. So this is for the endocrinologists in the room. So the thought is that it may alter the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. And what's the evidence for that? And I'm really condensing tons of papers, et cetera, into these three bullets. So there are numerous papers showing an increased level of corticotropin-releasing hormone in black women who deliver preterm infants. Okay, so there's your evidence. There's the vascular theory, and we think that chronic life course stress exposures may alter vascular function, which can result in altered placental blood flow or increased exposure to risk factors such as hypertension. And then there's the infectious disease theory. And this one I found the most interesting is that what we know for sure is that bacterial vaginosis increases with stress. So when women are stressed, they have a higher incidence of bacterial vaginosis. Well, what we also know is when compared to Caucasian women, African-American women tend to have much higher levels of or increased incidence of bacterial vaginosis. So these are very interesting theories, but it goes even further. So this is a schematic simply showing in a very cartoon fashion a little bit of what I've just said. So these are kind of major life events, any number of chronic stressors. The brain perceives it as stressful. And There are significant physiologic responses, which all essentially lead to an increase in allostatic load. So what is allostatic load? It's a term that was first coined in 1993 by McEwen and Steller, who are two neuropsychopharmacologists. And essentially what they talk about is it being a measure of cumulative biologic risk in response to the chronic stress. So think of it as a cumulative wear and tear of the body. And there are 11 components that are measured in order to calculate an allostatic load. And these are some of the components, so blood pressure, BMI, triglycerides, etc. And this is measured, and there's significant, I think, there's not complete understanding of exactly how these are measured, but it's believed to be the sum of the number of components for which an individual had a value within a high-risk range, okay? And again, there's ongoing debate as to how one should really measure allostatic load. Should you really look at factors that put you at higher risk for disease, or should you just have each component given an equivalent weight? But that said, in 2006, Arlene Geronimus from the University of Michigan, she's a public health researcher there, published an interesting paper entitled Weathering and Age Patterns of Allostatic Load Scores Among Blacks and Whites. And what she found is that allostatic loads of greater than 4 are considered to be very risky. And what we see in her work, and again, this is work that she did, I think, back in 2002 or 3 and published in 2006, is that when you look at gender and race, that black women, and I think looking back at her data, it was women in the age groups of 35 to 45 who were at highest risk for the probability of having an allostatic load greater than 4. When you look at allostatic load simply blacks and whites, then you see that there again, blacks have a much higher allostatic load, so a much higher wear and tear on the body. So I guess to summarize the infant mortality rate story, we then know that it isn't just genetics, though maybe that's playing a role, but that there are numerous environmental factors that are also playing a role with the disparities seen in infant mortality rate. So let's talk a little bit about environmental issues. So we'll talk about the built environment, which the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences defines as environments that are human-modified, including homes, schools, workplaces, highways, urban sprawl, and air pollution. And so I would like to talk about the impact of the built environment by telling two stories. And the first story is very common to all of us, that of the health supervision visit. So this is a 12-year-old boy who is brought to the clinic for a well child check. He seems to be doing well, but he has a weight that's over the 95th percentile. His BMI is 30. And you get a really thorough history, including information regarding physical activity. Mom says that he spends a fair amount of his time watching TV. He eats lunch provided to him by school. And because we're great doctors, we are eager to give useful anticipatory guidance. And you talk to them about the importance of fruit and vegetables, as well as packing a daily lunch. How many of you have said that to your patients before? I will confess. Okay. You encourage the child to get daily exercise because he's sitting around on the couch, perhaps at their neighborhood park. The mom looks at you and says, you know, it's just really hard. And, you know, you're a resident, so you come out and you're a little discombobulated and you're incredibly annoyed because you really want her to follow what you've asked her to do. How many of you have done that? Yeah. So these are a few questions I think that may come to mind when you're talking with your resident about it or when you're seeing your patients individually is what might be some of the barriers preventing the child's mom from packing a daily lunch? What does his school lunch consist of? Why does he spend so much time watching TV? Is it just because he loves TV? Well, a lot of kids love TV, but some have fewer choices, right? Does he have PE at school? And so we know that obesity has finally become a significant public health issue. We know that children from racial and ethnic minority and lower socioeconomic groups are disproportionately affected. And if you look at gender, it's very interesting. So we see that African-American girls have a very high rate, and Latino boys, specifically Mexican-American boys, and when you look at Latinos, the Mexican-American kids are higher than even other Latino groups of people. And so we think that there is something to be said about the inequality in the built environment for many of these patients, including things like lack of PE in public urban schools. Many of their parks are unsafe. They have fewer recreational facilities. And then their patient behaviors, cultural factors, attitudinal issues that contribute. And this is, again, repeating some of what I've just shown you. And in the interest of time, I'll move on. So the built environment, there are three primary components that we think about when looking at health disparities from an environmental perspective, essentially communities and neighborhoods in which our patients live, social and cultural issues, so that context needs to be kept in mind, and lastly, healthcare access issues. And I'm only going to talk about communities and neighborhoods really quickly. And this is not necessarily worth repeating. It looks very similar to the model that I showed you earlier. Just another reminder that when looking at health disparities, the exposure disease stress model continues to hold true. And so we are vulnerable at a community level and also at an individual level in terms of stress impacting our lives. So what is it about these communities and neighborhoods in which our patients live? Well, many of our kids are in neighborhoods where liquor stores, fast foods are much more accessible than supermarkets that sell fresh fruits and vegetables. And it's rather interesting. If you find a mainstream supermarket in one of our more distressed urban communities, and I would encourage all of you to go through some of our neighborhoods and go price the produce in some of these grocery stores, because they're actually much higher. The prices are higher, and the reason for that is the consumption is less, so they mark the prices up. So it's sort of a double whammy. So when you do find a market, you can't afford to buy what you're being asked to purchase. Many of our kids also live in very old and poorly maintained houses. Violence can and often is part of their day-to-day lives. So when we talk about violence education as part of our anticipatory guidance in our day-to-day clinic and health supervision visits, oftentimes when you ask a family about violence, they'll say things are fine. But in fact, they may be talking about within the confines of their own homes, but outside may not be so fine. Traffic patterns and construction projects that create noise and air pollution tend to be located more so in these urban neighborhoods. And lastly, there are way fewer parks, and when they do exist, they're often unsafe. We have partnered as a prime group with some of our urban planning and studies colleagues on the main campus, and they've recently done an asset mapping project looking at various urban communities throughout San Diego, and it was pretty striking in terms of the sparsity of green spaces located in many of these communities. Again, I would invite all of you to drive to some of these communities. So the last patient, and I'll go through this very briefly, is a 6-year-old asthmatic patient, night and day cough, has been kept home from school by mom. She has coughing fits at school per mom. In reviewing the chart, you notice that she was prescribed a controller medication 3 months before. However, mom was unable to get it filled because she was told by the pharmacy that it wasn't covered by her insurance. She has been using her albuterol, but it no longer works. So what questions may come to mind. Well, why were you not notified that the medication wasn't covered either by mom or the pharmacy? So again, some patient behavior issues maybe. I think it's important for you to question the environmental factors that may be contributing to her symptoms, both at school and at home. And lastly, has school absenteeism become a chronic problem? I showed you earlier that this can be a problem for many of our kids who come from lower SES groups. So asthma is the most common chronic disease in children, affecting upwards of 10% of pre-adolescent kids in our country. as we saw with the other diseases that I presented, it's more prevalent in African American and Latino populations, and we think that that's a multifactorial issue, cultural and environmental factors, healthcare access issues, and healthcare quality issues. For our colleagues in the emergency department, this also accounts for a very high emergency department utilization amongst minority children. This is a survey from the LA County Public Health Department, and it shows a significant increase in, as I've pointed out, in asthma in the African-American population. If one looks at admission rates for asthmatic children, it's high as well. So I think we should now pause and ask ourselves, where do we go from here? So I've presented you with some information, some data on disparities in kids. Well, Healthy People 2020, which is our national health agenda, has as its second overarching goal achieving health equity and eliminating health disparities and improving the health of all groups. And I will remind you that our 2010, Healthy People 2010, also had a very similar overarching goal. And I think when that was proposed, we all knew that it would take more than a decade or 2 decades or 3 decades to really tackle this particular problem. So a few helpful, I hope, strategies. I think it's important to communicate evidence-based results. I've shared with you some data, but there's still a whole lot that we absolutely have not a clue about these disparities. So community-based participatory research is very important. Our UCSD Clinical and Translational Research Institute now has a community engagement unit, which Howard Harris oversees, and I think that's a great group to partner with. We have our own UC San Diego Comprehensive Research Center in Health Disparities out of our community pediatrics group, another group that's very active in the mission of elimination of health disparities. I think it's important to increase access to care for low-income and minority populations with the Affordable Care Act. There's a timeline for that, and by 2013, we're supposed to have more kids insured and the under SCHIP. And the insurance issue for children is real interesting because 50% of all kids who are currently uninsured are eligible for insurance. So it's more than simply the access issue, as one thinks about access. We have to figure out a more proactive and creative ways to really get these kids enrolled. I think it's important to improve quality and outcomes in the healthcare system. So really being part of healthcare services research is going to be important as we move forward. And we need to develop preventive approaches at the community level. The U.S. Department of Education is in its second year of awarding Promise Neighborhood Grants. And these are, it's 20 grants given per year, 5 for implementation of programs and 10 for planning programs. And one of our Chula Vista groups, one of the community health services or community services in Chula Vista, was the recipient of one of the 2011 Promise Neighborhood grants. And the interesting thing about this grant is it focuses primarily on educational disparities, but certainly I've already said that these go hand in hand with health disparities. And lastly, we really need to build a knowledge base to understand the connection between socioeconomic status, race, prevention, and health. And lastly, I think for all of us in the room as pediatricians, you know, I talked about sort of bigger level programs. What can we do day to day? Well, I think that it's really important that you learn your community. And our residents are pretty much experts at this because they go out to their continuity clinic communities and do what's called a community snapshot. Our prime students also go out and do community snapshots. So I think that it's important to learn the issues, know the resources in the communities of the kids that you serve. Know what's happening at the schools, because in fact, kids spend a lot of time at schools. We already talked about supermarkets, and know if there's a farmer's market in your local community. I think it's important to form collaborative relationships with schools, with community-based organizations and community members. And I think that it's important that you know your community leaders. So who in your community really motivates the people in that community? That's extraordinarily important. And it's important that we all learn our local and state legislators, and we, because I think as pediatricians, it really allows us an opportunity to have a significant advocacy role. And with that, I will leave you with a quote in honor of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who essentially said that of all the forms of inequality, injustice in health is the most shocking and the most inhumane. Thanks.
We have time for a few questions.
This is called Absolutely Terrific.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Is this on? Yeah. Absolutely Terrific. Thank you very much. I just have a quick question, Lindy. I'm sure there are a lot of questions in the audience. I just want to touch upon one. In your allostatic load graphs, these were very intriguing. How were they normalized for? Were they normalized to income? Were they normalized to socioeconomics?
All of the above, correct. I should have said that at the beginning. Just as we saw with the papers that looked at infant mortality rates, looking at black women versus white women, all of those factors were held constant as well. And so I should have mentioned that, in fact, when we saw the increase for women, black women, right, in that age group, that was holding socioeconomics, et cetera, constant. Correct.
Thank you for coming again. You are just a great speaker. I was curious. I didn't hear you mention the question of the right to health care versus health care as a privilege. And I wondered if you could just comment about that whole topic.
The real moral issue is whether one thinks healthcare is a right or a privilege, and to speak a bit to that. I would say that if one kind of follows the public health model, one of the very first statements when you look at anything dealing with public health is that healthcare is a right. And it is something that society really needs to embrace as a right for all people. And I alluded to the book, The Healing of America. And the interesting thing is when comparing our country and how we think about healthcare more as a privilege, if you look at countries like Japan, the UK, and many other places, Sweden, Germany, etc., I think to some degree that's been some of their success. It's because they have owned that it is a right. In fact, it's an interesting thing. If I were to go to many of these countries just as an outsider visiting, I would be essentially able to get the same quality, the same kind of care that their citizens get. So I think that we continue as a major industrialized country to really, we've isolated ourselves. And I didn't intend to make any statements in that regard, but I think it's a dangerous path because it really is creating significant issues and problems for many subgroups in our country. I don't know if that sort of answers your question.
Are there any programs at the current time for mentoring for the children in poverty or underserved areas?
So the question is, are there mentoring numerous? And many of these are faith-based programs, even throughout San Diego. So I think that is part of, I talked about the Promised Neighborhood grants that are being given by the Department of Education, and that has a mentoring component as well. And certainly that is a piece that's quite important in moving forward the agenda of elimination of health disparities.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I'd like to thank Lindia. I'd like to thank you all for coming.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.